In our next segment, we move to a story that gets very little to practically no attention in the global corporate media, and that's the annual United Nations Gathering of Indigenous Communities. Member states of the UN have been urged to make sure that the post-2015 development agenda takes into account the rights of Indigenous peoples. The appeal was made once again by UN Deputy Secretary General Jan Eliasson at the start of the 14th session of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues on Monday. That forum is taking place as we speak here in New York. Mr. Eliasson said, "Now is the time for Indigenous peoples to be at the forefront of a transformative agenda that leaves no one behind," unquote. Making sure no one left behind, I guess that's the issue, and that's the struggle of the guests that we have in the studio here today, activists who've come from around the world to be part of the forum. And it's a pleasure to have you all here in the studios to talk about your experiences and about the forum itself. We're going to go around the room here. First, welcoming you all. We're joined by Lucy Mulenke from Kenya. She is the executive director of the Indigenous Information Network Kenya, and she's a Maasai from Kenya who's been working both as a chairperson and coordinator of the African Indigenous Women's Organization in the East African region. She's worked on a number of initiatives for Indigenous peoples, including issues around the environment, sustainable development, and the post-2015 development agenda and climate change. Lucy, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Alina Saba from Nepal. Alina is a young Limbu indigenous woman from the eastern part of Nepal. She's currently working with the Mughal Indigenous Women Upliftment Institute as a climate change action researcher, which is probably the most important job you can have right now at this stage of the game. She was selected as a panelist at the 2014 United Nations Climate Summit in New York City, which was pretty important considering there were about 500 plus applicants for that. And I guess you got inside while there were also thousands of people outside. But Alina, welcome to First Voices. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
And then finally, but last but not least, we're joined by Candy Lee Marie Mossett from right here in the USA. Candy's a member of civil society. She's a tribal member of the Mandan Hidatsa Arikara Tribal Nation of the state of North Dakota. And she's basically here representing a number of organizations, but the Indigenous Environmental Network. Candy's offered testimony in U.S. Congress on a number of issues related to climate change, social, and its impact on social and environmental, its consequences, and the health impacts. And she's currently focusing on something that we've spoken a lot about here, and that's the issue of hydraulic fracturing. The fracking, which here in New York State has been banned, but around the country there's a push for a federal ban. So, Candy Lee, I look forward to talking to you about that, and welcome to New York City.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
We have a lot to talk about, and always under the tyranny of the clock. So I wanted to start, and all of you to comment on this. The UN Forum, you know, it happens every year. It's an exciting period and space where communities from around the world really get to talk and meet with each other. But there's also criticisms that it's really a high-profile get-together. I've spoken to indigenous activists on the ground in Latin America, for example, who criticize the leaders for going and saying, oh, you're just going de paseo. You're just going on a trip, right? You're having a nice trip. So how important, and I want you all to comment on it, especially you, Lucy, since you've been here so much and at the outset of the forum, how important is the UN Forum on Indigenous Issues worldwide?
I think the permanent forum is very, very important because in the first place, indigenous peoples themselves advocated for it to have such a forum at the United Nations headquarters. And the main issue was that we realized that most of the issues were not being put in any agenda. And so bringing and having voices at the UN level was very critical because people will listen to them. Member states will be able to take up some of the issues on board. And indeed, since the permanent forum started, this is the 14th session now, there have been quite a lot of discussions. And indeed, most of those recommendations have been put in the agenda, like the process of Rio, when the Rio process was going on to go to the 20th meeting of the Rio conference, the Art Summit. And looking at the Millennium Development Goals, the post-2015 agenda, if it was not for the permanent forum to be here and to have the secretariat here, most of those recommendations would not be going anywhere because nobody would present them to anybody. And the permanent forum, apart from people really making statements, there are also so many other activities that take place. Right. Because indigenous people are able to dialogue with the UN agencies. The UN agencies come in, they present, they give give the opportunities that are there for indigenous people. And the forum has kind of created actually an open door for indigenous people to be able to advocate for their issues, even at the country level. Mm-hmm.
Lucy, you that work on communication, and we had just spoken to the woman Rosa Palomino from Peru talking mm-hmm. about the importance of communication. Even though it does not get any recognition or coverage in the kind of mainstream, it doesn't matter, do you think? I mean, what is the significance that it doesn't get covered? You'll do a Google search right now for the UN Forum and you might find one or two articles about it from very small media.
Yes, it's true that is missing. But indigenous people have also tried as much as possible to put some of those issues on their own, you know, websites and so on, and to bring the discussion. But we know that globally and in most countries, name it in Africa, mm-hmm. in Asia, some countries are not really able to allow indigenous people to have their own community radios, to have their own radio stations, to be able to highlight these issues. And that's why the reason why most of those who are out there saying people are going on holiday,
right,
because they don't get a feedback. So if they get a feedback of what is happening here, then they will not say that. But we still have a long way to be able to organize ourselves in those areas.
Well, I want to talk about specifics in Kenya, but Alina Saba, Lucy mentioned the issue of member states, and you come from Nepal, yeah, where there's so many issues that you're struggling with. How has the member state of Nepal responded to some of the demands that you've been making vis-a-vis all these different issues that we've been talking about?
Well, Nepal is, Nepal is one of the country who is one of the one who gives their statement on indigenous people, one of the good one and nicest one and pleasant one, because we are the one who have ratified the ILO and UN RIP. But the problem is what happens back home, they never get implemented and incorporated in the local, in the national laws, in the local policies. So, at the international level, our state representatives are praised and they are respected for what have been achieved for the rights of indigenous people. But it's only on the paper. Nothing goes on the ground. Nobody knows what kind of actions or policies have been ratified by our state, what our rights are in ILO and UN RIP. Mm-hmm. It never gets implemented. So the implementation and accountability part is the biggest issue for us, mm-hmm. and it has to be dealt with. So coming here from the working from the grassroots organizations, coming to the like UN Permanent Forum for the first time, my experience is like more youths and indigenous women should be directly representative rather than some member state representative and talking on behalf of our issue here. We would be the one who would give the clear and true picture of what our conditions are back home.
Mm-hmm. So talk about that. You write in a recent blog post that women are for the most part the most ignored in these processes. But here you are, I see three, and I know that there's many others who are accompanying you in this delegation. I think there's 12 different women that are specifically involved in this delegation. I see you all pretty strong and your voices are pretty, pretty powerful. What are you doing concretely on the ground to contest and hold the state and the government of Nepal accountable around these issues, environmental, territorial, all these other issues?
Through climate justice, feminist participatory climate justice action research, we are not just only documenting the impacts of climate change in the lives of women, but we are also involving women as a part of researcher. It's not an academic research, but it's not only the research and documenting what kind of impacts is there. By side, on the same way, we are also trying to bring the structural changes by giving them more knowledge and resources, by making them aware about climate change, because although they are facing the impacts, they don't know it is happening due to climate change. They haven't heard the term like climate change, mitigation, adaptation. So we are giving them knowledge and resources, trying to influence the local policies and trying to intervene the space for women in the local decision-making level, because we think it is important. If we have a strong presence at local decision-making, that will by default, we will have a strong position in national decision-making level and international decision-making mm-hmm. level. It's the first chain which links to us, the local level, to the international movement. So through this project, I'm working in the remotest area of the country where there is like they are isolated so much. And even the national, our own government does not know their story. So our first and important strategy is to influence the local level mm-hmm. bodies.
And I think that's important because we come to the UN and you have these summits and you're sharing and exchanging experiences, and then but when you go back home, you realize that even in your own country,
yes.
there is a profound level of ignorance, yes. indifference, and direct hostility
yep.
towards the demands and the issues that you're all raising.
Yes.
I want to get Candilee Marie Mosset in, but basically really ask all of you, because it seems that, or is it fair to say that all the issues of territorial integrity and control and rights, cultural rights, protecting the human rights of indigenous communities, struggles around security and lack of security because of the direct targeting around the world of indigenous communities, development issues, all these issues can now kind of fall under the broad banner of climate change? Or is that fair to say, or am I stretching that? Because it seems that climate change somehow has a relevance to every one of those specific issues. You know, the idea of extraction, you have to target communities. Mm-hmm. To target communities, you violate their rights and their territorial rights, etc. You can all comment, but Candy, to get you into the discussion, your thoughts about that.
Well, I would say that the important big picture item is that everything is connected, and as indigenous peoples, we've always sort of understood that. And now climate change is sort of something that we can use to show people that connection to the land, the air, the water. And we've been being impacted for hundreds of years already. And now that it's impacting more than just indigenous peoples, I think that people are taking notice, you know, standing up and seeing that platform is there. So yeah, we've been targeted for quite a while, and it is a way for us to come in here and to say that we have traditional knowledge. We have an intimacy with the land and understanding of the respect that we need to have in order to bring our ecosystems back into balance. It can happen, but I think part of the problem within the United Nations system is that there are a lot of false solutions that are put forth when it comes to climate change and how to deal with it. And these are carbon-based trading mechanisms that allow rich corporations to continue to be rich and governments that want money to continue to be rich, which still negatively impact our indigenous peoples. And so it's important for us to be here to hold the line.
Talk about some of those more specifically, and the campaign, the No Red, No Colonialism campaign that you're involved in. Could you talk to us about that?
Sure. RED officially stands for Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Degradation.
Right.
And it's a carbon offset mechanism which actually privatizes the air. So it's putting a price on the air we breathe, which is very crazy in my mind. Mm-hmm. We actually call it, read the acronym, reaping profits from evictions, land grabs, deforestation, and destruction of biodiversity. Because what they do in a lot of communities is lie, flat out lie to the people, like they did when they first came here to America, where, you know, we were here, and all of the people that came told us lies, and now they're doing that in other countries. And basically it's to in some cases put monocrop plantations up, and they call that carbon offsets.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can go into another country and say that they're going to protect a forest and they're not going to cut it down, or they're going to cut it down and put up monocrop. And then in my place in North Dakota, they'll do a new coal-fired power plant, or they'll do a new oil refinery, and they're buying carbon credits from that other country and saying it's okay because we're offsetting it. And it's
right.
a very false solution.
It's a height of, you know, working in illogical ways, but somehow it's being accepted as a way to address it. But then when there's actions of resistance to this, because communities are not stupid, when they block highways, when they take action, there's a doubling down even harder on the communities. And I wanted, if you can talk about it in Kenya, if you can share with us, Lucy, some specific examples, some of the things that you're struggling with right now, notwithstanding the gains that might have been made, and certainly those that are on paper, but on the ground, what are some of the specific issues you're dealing with, climate change and otherwise, given that climate change encompasses so many different issues?
Yes, thank you very much. I just want to pick up on what she was talking about. And the most important thing is that people don't realize that you have to begin from the ground. When you have poor communities struggling to survive for the day, and then the population pressure that's already on, there's increase of population, and they will go for those resources. They will go, for example, to the forest areas and cut down, burn charcoal, log and sell and so on. So some of those critical issues are things that need to be addressed so that we look, the governments should look at the policies they've set and be able to look at them and implement them. Because one of the key problems we have is that policies are there, every other beautiful law is there, but when you come to the ground level, people don't even know what happens, just as what Nepal has said. Some of the poverty areas in the countries where they live, very remote areas, the communities hardly can survive there. Like, we have, if you tell us to stop logging, what do we do? What do we do for survival? Mm-hmm. So these are some of the things that we keep on addressing at the community level. But the most important thing that we do is to make sure that we strengthen the capacity of the communities to make sure that they learn and they know that even if they destroy these resources, they are theirs and they will be the one most impacted. Mm-hmm. But if you have a community that is well much aware and can be able to take a few steps ahead to protect what is there, and as she's already said, there is indigenous knowledge, traditional communities come into that holistic way that this we've been given this by our gods, and our grandparents have been looking after them, so we should also take care of them. But the states really and other outsiders don't give them a chance to do that, because if somebody comes in and destroys it, it becomes a problem. The climate change problem will continue for a long time unless we all get together to take action. I'm surprised when I was here in the U.S., when I'm here, to hear the shortage of water. We have the same problem, and we've been told all the time that in 50 years' time, maybe there'll be no water in Africa and even in my own country. Mm-hmm. But when it rains, we don't take measures to harvest that rainwater, to make it there and to tell people how to use the water and so on. And I think it's also been mentioned in the previous listening that we've been able to hear here. So it's a question of people being able to look after their resources and using their own, let them be recognized that they are there and they can use their own traditional way of looking after those resources. And that's the way we can be able together to merge science and tradition and see how we can minimize climate change.
You're all three of you are here with a delegation of another 9-10 women from around the world, from Nicaragua, from Central America, from other parts of the world, and obviously raising all these issues unique to your own experiences, but also that are shared experiences. So let's get to that issue of the role of women. Is there an equal platform at the UN? Do you feel that there? Maybe Alina, you can talk a little bit about that. The role of women in making these, because you're at the front lines, the receiving end of these policies. So talk about that.
Platform for the role of women in UN, places like UN, I would say big no.
Kind of had kind of expected that answer, but
yes, because women are the ones at the ground who are at the front lines of climate change. They know what is the problem.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
They are the one who harvest their crops, who fetch water, who collects fodder, who saves the seeds, who collects the firewood, the entire process of planting and farming until putting food on the table to their family. That's the whole, the cycle is on the hand of women. But then they are the one left behind when in the places like policy making where there are like other people decide what needs to be done for them, whereas they know what they want. So there's these things are happening in a quite opposite way, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. So it's time for now to bring the women directly to the spaces like this, to let them say what are their problems.
Mm-hmm. Lucy, you wanted to comment on that?
Yes, I think this is a very critical issue. And at one point, the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues dedicated one forum to discuss women issues only, and so many issues, because we realize that even as the forum continues to discuss, we needed to make sure that women are visible, because we have always to struggle, and I don't know why, and yet they are majority in the world, but all the time we have to struggle to have our voices. So the UN forum had to dedicate this, and so many issues came up. Even right now at the discussion, and even last year, issues of violence came up, And even climate, in terms of climate, also the issues of indigenous women and violence and climate change, they keep coming up all the time. And I must also say that the UN has tried with the UN women to discuss issues of indigenous women, not only indigenous women, but women in general. But you see, the indigenous women have to keep on struggling to make, to have a voice there, because we have the majority women globally being there. Mm-hmm. And these indigenous women are the ones who are in the remote areas. Mm-hmm. So those voices, bringing them on the table, is a struggle. Mm-hmm. But we have to keep on trying.
Candy, and I guess we have a few moments left. Your last thoughts on that?
Well, I just wanted to say that it's important because women are the carriers of life. You know, we bring up the children. And it's no coincidence that when we carry these babies, they're carried in water. Water is life. And when you see all of these men in suits walking around in the UN, they're generally older men, and they're generally Caucasian, white men that are walking around making decisions on behalf of people that they won't even be around for the outcomes and consequences of the decisions they're making. So not only women, but youth. And one of the youth statements that happened was, do not tell us what we need. Listen to us and ask us what we need. And that's the same for women. Don't tell us what we need. We know.
Well, that's a good way to close the discussion. I wish we had more time. I want to thank you all for being with us. Candy Lee Marie Mossett, again, just speaking with us. We're here from the U.S. representing the Indigenous Environmental Network. We were speaking with Lucy Malenke from Kenya, the Executive Director of the Indigenous Information Network in Kenya. And we were also joined here by Alina Saba from Nepal. She's with the Mughal Indigenous Women Upliftment Institute, climate change action researcher. Thank you all for joining us. And I want to thank Madre and the Rosa Luxemburg Stiftung for making this arrangement possible. So I thank you all and salute you all for the work that you're doing, for lifting up the earth, indeed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And remember, if you educate a woman, you educate the whole world. But if you educate a man, you're only educating an individual. Thank you.
Beautiful.